Side 10. The Shining Ones. The Tomilly, Book 2. By David Eddings. Continuing on page 338.
This brings us to the coup attempt, Elana said. Krieger told Sparhawk that it wasn't intended to succeed, that it was only designed to force us to reveal our strengths and weaknesses. Was he actually telling the truth?
In part, Majesty,
Zanisha replied.
In the main, however, was Zelasta uncertain about the truth of Annika's declaration that he had cast Belium into the sea? Sought he by raising rebellion in the streets of Matherion and endangering all whom Annika held most dear, to force him to reveal whether or no he still did possess the jewel?
We played right into his hands by going after it then, didn't we?
Khalad suggested. I don't think so, Sparhawk disagreed. We'd never have found out about Belium's awareness if we'd left it where it was. That's the thing that nobody knew about, except possibly Afriel. Azash didn't seem to know about it, and neither does Sirgon. I doubt that either one would have been so interested in it if they'd known that it might resist their commands, even to the point of obliterating this world if necessary.
All right, Khalad said. Now we know what's led up to all this. What happens next?
That lieth in the future, Khalad of Deimos,
Zanisha replied.
And the future is concealed from all. Know, however, that our enemies are in disarray. Zelasta's position as advisor to the Imperial government was at the core of all their plans.
How quickly will he be able to recover, Sophronia? Elana asked. You know him better than anyone. Will he be able to strike back immediately?
Possibly, Sophronia said. But whatever he does won't be very well thought out. Zelasta's hysteric, and we don't react well to surprises. He'll flounder for a while, destroying mountains and setting lakes on fire before he gets hold of himself.
We should hit him again, then, Bevier observed. We shouldn't allow him to recover his balance.
Here's a thought, Sarabian said. After we went through the secret files of the Interior Ministry, we decided to pick up only the top level of conspirators, the police chiefs and administrators in the various towns, for the most part. We didn't bother with the toadies and informers, largely because we didn't have enough jail space. The Interior Ministry was central to the whole conspiracy, I think, and now Zelasta and his friends will probably be forced to rely on the scrapings we left behind. If I send the Aetons out to make a more thorough sweep, won't that push Zelasta off balance all the more?
Let him start to settle down first, Sarabian, Sophronia advised. Right now he's so enraged that he probably wouldn't even notice.
Is Norcan still on the Isle of Tiga? Vanyan asked suddenly.
No,
Elana replied. I got tired of the forged letters he was sending me from there, so we sent him back to Aetan.
Good. I think we'd better get word of Zelasta's treachery to him as quickly as possible. Betwana really needs to know about it.
I'll see to it, Vanyan Preceptor, Engessa promised.
Thank you, Engessa Aetan. If that little outburst in the throne room is any indication of his present state of mind, Zelasta's totally out of control right now.
Infuriated to the brink of insanity,
Sophronia agreed. It was the first time she had spoken directly to Vanyan since the rupture between them. That fact gave Sparhawk some hope.
He'll almost have to do something then, won't he? Vanyan asked her. In his present state, inaction would be unbearable.
She nodded.
He'll respond in some way, she said. And since he wasn't at all prepared for what just happened, whatever he does won't have been planned out in advance.
So it'll have large holes in it, won't it?
Probably.
Most likely it would involve the use of main force, Sparhawk added. Enraged people usually try to smash things. You'd better alert Norcan and Betwana to the possibility, Engessa Aetan, Sarabian instructed.
It shall be as you say, Sarabian Emperor.
Vanyan began to pace up and down.
Zelasta's still more or less in command, he said. At least he will be until he does something so stupid that Sirgon replaces him. Why don't we let him have his temper tantrum, crush it, and then round up all the minor conspirators. Let's frighten our opponents just a bit. If they see us methodically smashing everything they've gone to so much trouble to prepare, and rounding up all their friends, they'll start having thoughts about their own mortality. At that point, I think Sirgon's going to have to show himself, and then Sparhawk can turn Belium loose on him.
I hate it when he's like this, Sophronia said to Zanisha. He's so certain, and probably so right. Men are much more appealing when they're just helpless little boys.
The casual-seeming remark was startling. Sophronia was clearly stepping over ancient racial antagonisms between Styric and Delphae, and speaking to Zanisha as one woman to another.
Then all we really have to do is sit here and wait for Zelasta's next move, Sarabian observed. I wonder what he's going to do.
They did not have to wait long for the answer. A few days later, an exhausted Aton stumbled across the drawbridge with an urgent message from Ambassador Norcan.
Huskanya, the message began with characteristic abruptness, round up every Aton you can lay your hands on and send them all here. The trolls are dismantling northern Aton right down to the very bedrock.
Chapter 23 We can't send them in Gesa Aton, Sarabian said. We need them right where they are. At the moment, they're all that's holding the Empire together.
Engesa nodded.
I understand the situation, Sarabian Emperor, but Betwana Queen will only wait for so long. If the lands of the Aetons are in peril, she will have no choice but to act. She will order the Aetons home, despite her alliance with you.
She's going to have to pull her people back, Vanyan advised the huge Aeton. She doesn't have enough warriors to defend the north against the trolls. So she may have to abandon northern Aton for a while. We won't be able to send full garrisons to her aid, but we can pull one or two platoons out of each garrison. That's several thousand warriors altogether, but it's going to take them longer to reach Aton because they're so spread out. She'll just have to pull back until we can get there.
We are Aton's, Vanyan Preceptor. We do not run away.
I'm not suggesting that, Engesa Aton. All your queen will be doing is repositioning her forces. She can't hold the north at the moment, and there's no point in wasting lives trying. The best we can do for her in the meantime is to send some Genidian advisors and Serenic technical assistance.
Not quite, friend Vanyan, Kring said. I'll go to Takumi in central Astel. The eastern Poloi aren't as fearful of forests as my children are, and Takumi loves a good fight as much as I do, so he'll probably bring several thousand horsemen with him. I'll gather up a few hundred bowmen and come to Aton ahead of his main force.
Your offer is generous, friend Kring, Engesa said.
It's a duty, Engesa Aton. You serve as Mirtai's father, and that makes us kinsmen.
Kring absently rubbed his hand across his shaved scalp.
The bowmen are very important, I think. Your Aetons have moral reservations about using bows in warfare. But when we met those trolls in eastern Astel, we found out that you can't really fight them without shooting them full of arrows first.
Here's another thought, Khalad said, holding up his crossbow. How do your people feel about these, Engesa Aeton?
Engesa spread his hands.
It is a new device here in Tamali, Khalad Squire. We have not yet formed an opinion about it. Some Aetons may accept it, others may not.
We wouldn't have to arm all the Aetons with crossbows, Khalad said.
He looked at Sparhawk.
Will you be needing me here, my lord?
He asked.
Why don't you see if you can persuade me that I won't?
That's a cumbersome way to put it, Sparhawk. We've still got all those crossbows we gathered up when we put down the coup. I broke most of them, but it won't take me too long to fix them again. I'll go north with Engesa Aeton and the technical advisors. Engesa can try to persuade his people that the crossbow's a legitimate weapon of war, and I'll teach them how to use it.
I'll join you in Aetana later, Kring told them. I'll have to lead Takumi's bowmen to the city. The Poloi tend to get lost in forests.
Never mind, Mirtai, Aelana told the giantess, whose eyes had suddenly come alight. I need you here.
My betrothed and my father are going to war, Aelana, Mirtai objected. You can't expect me to stay behind.
Oh, yes, I can. You can't go, and that's final.
May I be excused?
Mirtai asked stiffly.
If you wish,
Mirtai stormed toward the door.
"Don't break all the furniture,"
Elana called after her. It was really only a small domestic crisis, but it was a crisis all the same, largely because the royal princess Danae declared that she would die if her missing cat was not found immediately. She wandered tearfully around the throne room, climbing into laps, pleading and cajoling. Sparhawk was once again able to observe the devastating effect his daughter could have on someone's better judgment when she was sitting in the person's lap.
"Please help me find my cat, Sarabian," she said,
touching the Emperor's cheek with one small hand. Sparhawk had long since learned that the first rule in dealings with Danae was never to let her touch you. Once she touched you, you were lost.
"We all need some fresh air anyway, don't we?" Sarabian said to the others. "We've been sitting in this room for more than a week now. Why don't we suspend our discussions and go find Princess Danae's cat? I think we'll all be fresher when we come back."
"Score one for Danae." Sparhawk smiled.
"I'll tell you what," Sarabian continued. "It's a beautiful morning. Why don't we make an outing of it? I'll send word to the kitchens, and we can all have our lunches out on the lawns."
He smiled down at Danae, whose hand might just as well have been wrapped around his heart.
"We'll celebrate the return of Myrrh to her little mistress."
"What a wonderful idea," Danae exclaimed, clapping her hands together. "You're so wise, Sarabian."
They all smiled indulgently and rose to their feet. Sparhawk privately admitted that the Emperor was probably right. The long day's conferences were beginning to make them all just a little fuzzy-headed. He went to his daughter and picked her up.
"I can walk, Father," she protested.
"Yes, but I can walk faster. My legs are longer. We do want to find Myrrh as soon as possible, don't we?"
She glared at him. "You've got everybody under control," he murmured to her. "You don't have to herd them around like sheep. What's this all about? You can call Myrrh back home any time you feel like it. What are you really up to?"
"There are some things I want to get settled before we get too busy, Sparhawk. And I can't do anything with all of you huddled together in this room like a flock of chickens. I need to get you all out of here so that I can straighten things out."
"Is Myrrh really lost?"
"Well, of course she isn't. I know exactly where she is. I just told her to go chase grasshoppers for a while."
"What sort of things were you talking about? Exactly what is it that you want to get straightened out?"
"Watch, Sparhawk," she told him. "Watch and learn."
"It's just not done, Calton,"
Aileen said in a sorrowfully resigned voice as the two walked out across the drawbridge with Sparhawk and Danae not far behind.
"What do you mean, not done?"
"You're a knight, and I'm only a peasant girl. Why can't we just leave things the way they are?"
"Because I want to marry you."
She touched his face fondly.
"And I'd give anything to be able to marry you. But we can't."
"I'd like to know why not."
"I told you already. We come from different social classes. A peasant girl can't marry a knight. People would laugh at us and say hateful things about me."
"Only once," he declared, clenching his fist.
"You can't fight the whole world, my love."
She sighed.
"Of course I can. Particularly if the world we're talking about consists of those butterflies that infest the court at Zamora. I could kill a dozen of them before lunchtime."
"No,"
she said sharply.
"No killing. Can't you see what that would do? People would grow to hate me. We'd never have any friends. That's all right for you, because you'll be off at whatever war Prince Sparhawk or Lord Vanyan sends you to. But I'll be completely alone. I couldn't bear that."
"I want to marry you," he almost shouted.
"It would make my life complete as well, my dear love," she sighed. "But it's impossible."
"I want you to fix that, Sparhawk," Danae said out loud.
"Quiet, they'll hear us."
"They can't hear us, Sparhawk, or see us either, for that matter."
"You're using a spell, I gather?"
"Naturally. It's a useful little spell that makes people ignore us. They kind of know we're here, but their minds don't pay any attention to us."
"I see. It tiptoes around the moral objection to eavesdropping, too, doesn't it?"
"What on earth are you talking about, Sparhawk? I don't have any moral problems with eavesdropping. I always eavesdrop. How else am I supposed to keep track of what people are doing?
tell Mother to give Aileen a title so that she and Colton can get married. I'd do it myself, but I'm busy. Take care of it.
Is this the sort of thing you were talking about earlier?
Of course. Don't waste time on all these silly questions, Sparhawk. We've got a lot more to do today. I do love you, Barret Knight,
Empress Elisoon said a little sadly.
But I love him, too.
And how many others do you love, Elisoon? Barret asked her acidly.
I've lost count.
The bare-breasted Empress shrugged.
Sarabian doesn't mind. Why should you?
Then we're through. You don't want to see me any more?
Don't be ridiculous, Barret Knight. Of course I want to see you again, as often as I possibly can. It's just that there are going to be times when I'll be busy seeing him. I didn't have to tell you this, you know. But you're so nice that I didn't want to go behind your back to...
She groped for a word. To be unfaithful, he said bluntly.
I'm never unfaithful, she said indignantly. You take that back right now. I'm the most faithful lady in the whole court. I'm faithful to at least a dozen young men, all at the same time.
He suddenly burst out laughing.
What's so funny? She demanded.
Nothing, Elisoon, he replied with a genuine fondness. You're so delightful that I can't help laughing. She sighed.
Life would be so much simpler for me if you men wouldn't take these things so seriously. Love's supposed to be fun, but you all scowl and wave your arms in the air about it. Go love somebody else for a while, I won't mind. As long as everybody's happy, what difference does it make who made them happy?
He smiled again.
You do still love me, don't you, Barret Knight?
Of course I do, Elisoon.
There. Everything's all right then, isn't it?
What was that all about?
Sparhawk asked his daughter. They were standing fairly close to Barret and Elisoon, close enough to make Sparhawk slightly self-conscious at any rate.
Barret was getting just a little too deeply involved with the naked girl,
Danae replied.
He's learned what she could teach him, so it's time for their friendship to calm down a little. I have other plans for him.
Have you ever considered letting him make his own plans?
Don't be ridiculous, Sparhawk. He'd just make a mess of things. I always take care of these arrangements. It's one of the things I do best. We better hurry. I want to look in on Kring and Mirtai. He's going to tell her something that isn't going to make her happy. I want to be there to head off any explosions.
They found Kring and Mirtai sitting on the lawn under a large tree ablaze with autumn color. Mirtai had opened the basket the kitchen had provided and was looking inside.
Some kind of dead bird, she reported.
Kring made a face.
I suppose it's civilized food, he said, trying to put the best face on it.
We're both warriors, my betrothed, she replied,
also looking less than happy with what had been prepared for their lunch.
We're supposed to eat red meat.
Stragan told me once that you ate a wolf when you were younger,
Kring said, suddenly remembering the story.
Yes,
she replied simply.
Do you mean you actually did?
He seemed stunned.
I thought he was just trying to fool me.
I was hungry,
she shrugged,
and I didn't have time to stop. The wolf didn't taste very good, but he was raw. If I'd had time to cook him, he might have been better.
You're a strange woman, my beloved.
That's why you love me, isn't it?
Well, it's one of the reasons. Are you sure we can't talk about our problem?
He was obviously coming back to a subject they had discussed before, many times.
There's nothing to talk about. We have to be married twice, once in Aetana, and then again when we get back to Pelosia. We won't be really married until we've gone through both ceremonies.
We'll be half married after the ceremony in Aetana, won't we?
Half married isn't good enough, Kring. I'm a virgin. I've killed too many men protecting that to settle for half married. You'll just have to wait.
He sighed.
It's going to take a long time, you know, he said mournfully.
It's not that far from Aetana back to your country. I'll race you there.
It's not the journey that's going to take so long, Mirtai. It's the 2 months you'll have to spend in my mother's tent before the wedding in Pelusia. You'll have to learn our practices and ceremonies.
She gave him a long, steady look.
You said I have to what?
There was an ominous tone in her voice.
It's the custom. A Paloi bride always lives for 2 months with the groom's mother before the ceremony.
Why?
To learn about him.
I already know about you.
Well, yes, I suppose you do, but it's the custom.
That's ridiculous.
Customs often are. But I am Domi, so I have to set a good example. And you'll be Doma. The Paloi women will have no respect for you if you don't do what's expected.
I'll teach them respect.
Her eyes had turned flint hard. He leaned back on his elbows.
I was sort of afraid you might feel this way.
He sighed.
Is that why you didn't mention it before?
I was waiting for the right time. Is there any wine in that basket? This might be easier if we're both more relaxed.
Let's wait. We can get relaxed after you tell me. What is this nonsense?
Let's see if I can explain it.
He rubbed his head.
When my people say that the bride is learning about her husband, it doesn't really mean that she's learning about what he expects for breakfast or things like that. What they're really talking about is the fact that there's property involved.
I don't have any property, Kring. I'm a slave.
Not after you marry me, you won't be. You'll be a very wealthy woman.
What are you talking about?
Paloi men own their weapons and their horses. Everything else belongs to the women. Always before, whenever I stole something, cattle usually, I gave it to my mother. She's been holding my wealth from me until I get married. She's entitled to some of it. That's what the 2 months is all about. It's to give the two of you time to agree on the division.
It shouldn't take us that long.
Well, probably not. My mother's a reasonable woman. But the two of you will also have to find husbands for my sisters. It wouldn't be so hard if there weren't so many of them.
How many?
Her voice was very hard now.
Eight, actually.
Eight?
She said it flatly.
My father was very vigorous.
So was your mother, apparently. Are your sisters presentable?
More or less. None of them are as beautiful as you are, though, love. But then who could be?
We can talk about that later. There's some kind of problem with your sisters, isn't there?
Kring winced.
How did you know that?
I know you, Kring. You saved mention of these sisters until the very last. That means that you didn't want to talk about them, and that means there's a problem. What is it?
They think they're rich. That makes them put on airs.
Is that all?
They're very arrogant, Mirtai.
I'll teach them humility.
She shrugged.
Since there are only eight, I should be able to do it all at once. I'll just take them all out into the nearest pasture for an hour or so. They'll be very humble when we come back, and eager to marry any men your mother and I choose for them. I'll make sure they're willing to do anything to get away from me. Your mother and I should be able to settle the property division in the morning. I'll civilize your sisters in the afternoon, and you and I can be married that same evening.
It's not done that way, my love.
It will be this time. I'm no more enthusiastic about waiting than you are. Why don't you come over here and kiss me? Now that everything's been settled, we should take advantage of this opportunity.
He grinned at her.
My feelings exactly, love.
He took her in his arms and kissed her. The kiss was rather genteel at first, but that didn't last for very long. Things turned slightly savage after a moment.
That's going to work out just fine, Danae said smugly. I wasn't sure how Mirtai was going to take the idea of living with Kring's mother, but she's got everything in hand now.
She's going to upset the Paloi, you know,
Sparhawk said.
They'll live.
The princess shrugged. They're too set in their ways anyhow. They need somebody like Mirtai to open their eyes to the modern world. Let's move on, Sparhawk. We're not done yet.
How long has this been going on?
Stragan asked in a slightly choked voice.
Since I was a little girl,
Melodir replied.
My father made the dyes when I was about 7 or so.
Do you realize what you've done, Baroness?
I thought you were going to drop the formality, Milord Stragan.
She smiled at him. He ignored that.
You've struck a direct blow at the economy of every kingdom in Eosia. This is monstrous.
Oh, do be serious, Stragan.
You've debased the coinage.
I haven't really. But why should it make any difference to you?
Because I'm a thief. You've devalued everything I've ever stolen.
No, not really. The value of the coins doesn't really have anything to do with their true weight. It's a matter of trust. People may not like their governments, but they trust them. If the government says that this coin is worth a half crown, then that's what it's worth. Its value is based on an agreement, not on weight. If the coin has milled edges, it has the value that's stamped on its face. I haven't really stolen anything.
You're a criminal, Melodir.
How can I be a criminal if I haven't stolen anything?
What if they find out about what you've been doing?
What if they do? They can't do anything about it. If they say anything or try to do something to me, I'll just tell the whole story, and every government in Eosia will collapse because nobody will trust their coins anymore.
She touched his cheek.
You're such an innocent, Stragan. I think that's why I'm fond of you. You pretend to be depraved, but actually you're like a little boy.
Why did you tell me about this?
Because I need a partner. I can handle these affairs in Eosia, but taking on Tomali as well might strain my resources. You have contacts here, and I don't. I'll teach you the business, and then lease Tomali to you. I'll buy you a title and set things up so that you can start immediately.
His eyes narrowed.
Why? He demanded. Why are you being so generous?
I'm not being generous, Stragan. You will pay your rent every month. I can see to that. And you won't pay in coins. I want bullion, Stragan. Nice solid bars of gold that I can weigh. And don't try mixing in any copper either. I'll have your throat cut if you ever try that.
You're the hardest woman I've ever known, Melodir.
He sounded slightly afraid of her.
Only in some places, Stragan,
she replied archly.
The rest of me is fairly soft. Oh, that reminds me, we'll be getting married.
Well, what?
Partnerships aren't made in heaven, my lord. Marriages are. Marriage will give me one more hold on you.
What if I don't want to get married?
He sounded a little desperate now.
That's just too bad, Stragan, because like it or not, you will marry me.
And you'll have me killed if I don't, I suppose.
Of course. I'm not going to let you run around loose with this information. You'll get used to the idea, my lord. I'm in a position to make you deliriously happy and fabulously wealthy to boot. When have you ever had a better offer?
The look in Stragan's eyes, however, was one of sheer panic.
Now that was something I didn't expect,
Danae said, as she and Sparhawk crossed the lawn. Sparhawk was almost too shocked to answer.
You didn't know about Melodir's little hobby, you mean?
Oh, of course I knew about that, Sparhawk. Melodir bought her way into Mother's Court several years ago.
Bought?
She paid an old countess to step aside for her. What I didn't expect was the direct way she approached Stragan. I thought she might soften things a little, but she was all business. She carved him into neat little slices, and she didn't give him any room to move at all while she did it. I think I've misjudged her.
No, actually, you misjudged Stragan. She used the only technique that had any chance of success with him. Stragan's very slippery. You've got to pin him to the plate with a fork before you can carve him. he probably wouldn't have listened to an ordinary marriage proposal, so she was all business with him. The marriage was only an incidental part.
Not to her, it wasn't.
Yes, I know. She did it right, though. I'm going to have to tell your mother about this, you know.
No, actually, you're not. You heard Mella, dear. Mother wouldn't be able to do anything about it. And all you do is worry her.
They're stealing millions, Afriel.
They're not stealing anything, Sparhawk. What they're going to do in no way changes the value of money. When you get right down to it, they're actually creating wealth. The whole world will be better for it.
I don't entirely follow the logic of that.
You don't have to, Father, she said sweetly. Just take my word for it.
She pointed.
We want to go over there next.
Over there was beside the moat, where Sophronia and Vanyan walked side by side along the grassy bank.
Sparhawk was growing accustomed to his de facto invisibility by now, but it was still strange to have one of his friends look directly at him without acknowledging his presence.
It would depend entirely on what kind of fish were locally available, Vanyan was explaining.
Sparhawk could tell that Vanyan was explaining because he was using his explaining voice, which was quite a bit like his preaching voice. Vanyan had put whole generations of Pandian novices to sleep, both in the lecture hall and in chapel.
Why is he talking like that?
Danae asked.
Because he's afraid, Sparhawk sighed.
Of Sophronia? Vanyan isn't afraid of anything, least of all Sophronia. He loves her.
That's what's making him afraid. He doesn't know what to say. If he says the wrong thing, it could all fall apart again.
Now, Vanyan continued to lecture, there are warm water fish and cold water fish. Carp like the water to be warm, and trout like it colder.
Sophronia's eyes were starting to glaze over.
The water in the moat has been standing for quite a while, so it's fairly warm. That would sort of rule out trout, wouldn't you say?
I suppose so,
she sighed.
But that doesn't mean that you couldn't plant some other kind of fish in there. A really good cook can do wonders with carp, and they do help to keep the water clean. There's nothing like a school of carp to keep standing water from turning stagnant.
No, she sighed. I'm sure there isn't. What on earth is he doing?
Danae exploded.
It's called walking on eggshells, Sparhawk explained. He probably talks a great deal about the weather, too.
They'll never get back together if he doesn't talk directly to her about something that matters.
He probably won't do that, Afriel. I think Sophronia is going to have to take the first step.
I found her!
Talon's shout came across the lawn.
She's up in this tree! Oh, bother,
Danae said irritably.
He wasn't supposed to find her yet. And what's she doing up a tree? She wasn't supposed to climb any trees.
We may as well go on over, Sparhawk told her. Everybody's drifting in that direction. You'd better dissolve your spell.
What about Vanyan and Sophronia?
Why don't we just let them work it out for themselves?
Because he'll go on talking about fish for the next 10 years, that's why.
Sophronia will only listen to lectures about fish for so long, Danae. Then she'll get to the point. Vanyan isn't really talking about fish. He's telling her that he's ready to make peace if she is.
He didn't say anything about that. He was just about to start giving her recipes for boiled carp.
That's what you heard him saying. But that wasn't what he was really saying. You've got to learn to listen with both ears, Danae.
Aline's, she said, rolling her eyes upward.
Then they heard Calton shout,
"Look out!"
Sparhawk looked sharply toward the spot where the others were gathered around a tall maple tree. Talon was up among the topmost branches, inching his way slowly out on a very slender limb toward the wild-eyed Myrrh. Things weren't going well. The limb was sturdy enough to support Myrrh, but Talon was too heavy. The limb was bending ominously, and there were unpleasant cracking sounds coming from its base.
"Talon!" Calton shouted again. "Get back!"
But by then, of course, it was too late. The tree limb did not so much break off from the trunk as it did split at its base and peel down the side of the tree. Talon made a desperate grab, caught the confused and terrified cat in one hand, and then plunged headlong down through the lower branches of the tree. The situation was still not irretrievable. The church knights were all versed in various levels of magic. Sophrenia was there, and Athriel herself rode on Sparhawk's shoulders. The problem was that no one could actually see Talon. The maple tree had large leaves, and the boy was falling down through the limbs, and was thus totally obscured by the foliage. They could hear him hitting limbs as he fell, a series of raps and thumps, accompanied by grunts and sharp cries of pain. Then he emerged from the lower foliage, falling limply to land with a thud on the grass under the tree, with Myrrh still loosely held in one hand. He did not get up.
"Talon!"
Danae screamed in horror. Sophrenia concurred with the opinion of Sarabian's physicians. Talon had suffered no really serious injuries. He was bruised and battered, and there was a large, ugly knot on his forehead from his encounter with the unyielding tree limb that had knocked him senseless. But Sophrenia assured them that aside from a splitting headache, he would have no lasting after-effects from his fall. Princess Danae, however, was in no mood to be reassured. She hovered at the bedside, reacting with little cries of alarm each time the unconscious boy stirred or made the slightest sound. Finally, Sparhawk picked her up and carried her from the room. There were people there who probably shouldn't witness miracles. "It got away from you, didn't it, Athriel?" he observed to the distraught child goddess.
"What are you talking about?"
"You had to tamper with things. Trying to fix things that would have fixed themselves if you'd just left them alone. And you almost got Talon killed in the process."
"It wasn't my fault that he fell out of the tree."
"Whose fault was it, then?" He knew that logically he was being grossly unfair, but he felt that maybe it was time for the meddling little goddess to be brought up short. "You interfere too much, Athriel," he told her. "People have to be allowed to live their own lives, and to make their own mistakes. We can usually fix our mistakes by ourselves if you'll just give us the chance. I suppose that what it gets down to is that just because you can do something doesn't always mean that you should do it. You might want to think about that." She stared at him for a long moment, and then she suddenly burst into tears.
"Takumi's bowman will help," Venian said to Sparhawk a bit later, when the two stood together on the parapet. "Olaf's right about trolls. You definitely want to slow them down before you fight them. And Khalad's idea about the crossbows isn't bad either."
"Right. Thank God you brought him along."
The preceptor pursed his lips.
"I'd like to have you take personal charge of Khalad's training when you get him back to Samura, Sparhawk. Make sure that he gets instruction in politics, diplomacy, and church law, as well as in military skills. I think he's going to go a long way in our order, and I want to be sure he's ready for any position."
"Even yours?"
"Stranger things have happened."
Sparhawk remembered Vanyan's lecture on fish that morning. "Are you making any progress at all with Sophrenia?" he asked.
"We're speaking to each other, if that's what you mean."
"It wasn't. Why don't you just sit down and talk with her? About something more significant than the weather, or how many birds can sit on a limb, or what kind of fish can live in the moat." Venian gave him a sharp look.
"Why don't you mind your own business?"
"It is my business, Venian. She can't function while there's this rift between you. And neither can you, for that matter. I need you. Both of you. And I can't really count on either of you until you resolve your differences."
"I'm moving as fast as I dare, Sparhawk. One wrong move here could destroy everything."
"So could a failure to move. She's waiting for you to take the first step. Don't make her wait too long." Stragan came out onto the parapet.
"He's awake now," he reported. "He's not very coherent, and his eyes aren't focused. But he's awake. Your daughter's making quite a fuss over him, Sparhawk."
"She's fond of him." Sparhawk shrugged. "She tells everybody that she's going to marry him someday."
Little girls are strange, aren't they?
Oh, yes. And Danny's stranger than most.
I'm glad I was able to catch the two of you alone, Strachan said then. There's something I'd like to talk over with you before I mention it to the others.
Strachan was absently twiddling two gold Hellenic half-crowns in his right hand, carefully running one fingertip across the milled edges and hefting them slightly, as if trying to determine their weight. Baroness Melodir's confession appeared to have unsettled him just a bit.
Zalasta's little fit of rage wasn't quite as irrational as we thought it would be. Turning the trolls loose on Northern Aton was the most disruptive thing he could have done to us. We'll have to deal with that, of course, but I think we'd better start preparing for his next move. Trolls don't need much supervision once they've been pointed in the right direction, so Zalasta's free to work on something else now, wouldn't you say?
Probably, Sparhawk agreed.
Now, I could be wrong,
but you don't think you are, Vanyan completed his sentence sardonically.
He's in a touchy mood today, isn't he? Strachan said to Sparhawk.
He's got a lot on his mind.
It's my guess that whatever Zalasta comes up with next is going to involve those conspirators Sarabian and Elana left in place for lack of jail cells.
It could just as easily involve the armies Perak, Amador, and Elrond have raised in Western Tomali,
Vanyan disagreed. Strachan shook his head.
Those armies were raised to keep the Church Knights off the continent, Lord Vanyan, and they were raised at Sirgon's specific orders. If Zalasta risked them now, he'd have to answer to Sirgon for it. And I don't think he's that brave yet.
Maybe you're right, Vanyan conceded. All right, let's say that he will use those second-level conspirators. Sarabian and Elana have already set things in motion to round them up.
Why bother rounding them up at all, my lord?
To get them off the streets, for one thing. Then there's also the small detail of the fact that they're guilty of high treason. They need to be tried and punished.
Why?
As an example, you idiot!
Vanyan flared.
I'll agree that getting them off the streets is important, Lord Vanyan, but there are more effective ways to make examples of people. Not only more effective, but more terrifyingly certain. When you send policemen out to arrest people, it's noisy, and usually others hear the noise and manage to escape. There's also the fact that trials are tedious, expensive, and not absolutely certain.
You've got an alternative in mind, I gather? Sparhawk said.
Naturally. Why not have the executions first and the trials later?
They stared at him.
I'm sort of extending the idea I had the other day, Strachan said. Calidor and I have access to a number of non-squeamish professionals who can carry out the executions privately.
You're talking about murder, Strachan, Vanyan accused.
Why, yes, Lord Vanyan. I believe that is the term some people do use to describe it. The whole idea behind examples is to frighten others so much that they won't commit the same crime. It doesn't really work, because criminals know that their chances of being caught and punished are very slim. He shrugged. It's just one of the hazards of doing business. We professional criminals break laws all the time. We don't, however, break our own rules. People in our society who break the rules aren't afforded the courtesy of being tried. They're just killed. No acquittals, no pardons, no last-minute jailbreaks. Dead. Period. Case closed. The justice of regular society is slow and uncertain. Ours is just the opposite. If you want to use terror to keep people honest, use real terror.
It has got possibilities, Vanyan, Sparhawk suggested tentatively. You're not seriously considering it, are you? There are thousands of those people out there. You're talking about the largest mass murder in history.
It's a way to get my name in the record books.
Strachan shrugged.
Calidor and I are probably going to do this anyway. We're both impatient men. I wouldn't have bothered you about it, but I thought I'd like to get your views on the subject. Should we tell Sarabian and Elana, or should we just go ahead and not bother them? Discussions about relative morality are so tedious, don't you think? The point here is that we need to come up with something that will unhinge Zelasta all the more, and I think this might be it. If he wakes up some morning in the not-too-distant future and finds himself absolutely and totally alone, it might give him some second thoughts about the wisdom of his course. And oh, incidentally, I've borrowed Barrett and Zanisha. They're taking a stroll in the vicinity of the Senescan Embassy so that Zanisha can run that dip net of hers through the minds of the people inside. We've got quite a few names, but I'm sure there are more.
Doesn't she have to be in the same room with somebody to listen to his thoughts?
Vanyan asked. She's not really certain. She's never really had occasion to test the limits of her gift. The expedition today is something in the nature of an experiment. We're hoping that she'll be able to reach in through the walls and pull out the names of the people inside. If she can't, I'll find some way to get her inside so that she can seine out what we need. Kalidor and I want as much information and as many names as we can get. Setting up the largest mass murder in history is a very complicated business, and we don't want to have to do it twice.
Chapter 24
It's diversionary, Uloth said the next morning.
He lowered one of the dispatches Emperor Sarabian had brought with him.
The werewolves and vampires and ghouls are just illusions, so they can't really hurt anybody. And these attacks on Eton garrisons are no more than suicidal gestures intended to keep things confused. This is just more of what they were doing before.
He's right, Sparhawk agreed. None of this is new, and it doesn't have any real purpose except to keep the Etons in place.
Unfortunately, it's succeeding very well, Bevier said. We can't reduce the Eton garrisons by very much to send help to Betwana with all this going on. Lord Vanyan's idea of detaching platoon-sized units from the main garrisons should help a little, Sarabian protested. Yes, Your Majesty, Bevier replied, but will it be enough?
It's going to have to be, Vanyan said. It's all we can spare right now. We're talking about Etons, though, and numbers aren't all that significant where they're concerned. One Eton is half an army all by himself.
Stragan motioned to Sparhawk, and the two of them drifted over to the long table laden with breakfast. The blonde thief carefully selected a pastry.
It worked, he said quietly. Zanisha has to be able to see the person whose thoughts she's stealing. But Barrett found a building that's fairly close, and quite a bit higher than the embassy. Zanisha's got a comfortable room to sit in, with a window that faces the ambassador's office. She's picking up all sorts of information, and names, for us.
Why are we keeping this from the others?
Because Kaalador and I are going to use the information to set that new world record I was telling you about yesterday. Sarabian hasn't authorized it yet, so let's not upset him over something he doesn't need to know about. At least not until we've stacked all the bodies in neat piles.
Princess Danae fell ill the next day. It was nothing clearly definable. There was no fever, no rash, and no cough involved, only a kind of listless weakness. The princess seemed to have no appetite, and it was difficult to wake her.
It's the same thing as it was last month, Mirtai assured the little girl's worried parents. She needs a tonic, that's all.
Sparhawk, however, knew that Mirtai was wrong. Danae had not really been ill the previous month. The child goddess made light of her ability to be in two places at the same time, but her father knew that when her attention was firmly fixed on what was going on in one place, she would be semi-comatose in the other. This illness was quite different somehow.
"Why don't you go ahead and try a tonic, Elana?" he suggested. "I'll go talk with Sophronia. Maybe she can think of something else."
He found Sophronia sitting moodily in her room. She was looking out the window, although it was fairly obvious that she did not even see the view.
"We've got a problem, little mother," Sparhawk said, closing the door behind him. "Danny's sick."
She turned sharply, her eyes startled.
"That's absurd, Sparhawk. She doesn't get sick. She can't."
"I didn't think so myself, but she's sick all the same. It's nothing really tangible, no overt symptoms or anything like that, but she's definitely not well."
Sophrenia rose quickly.
"I'd better go have a look," she said. "Maybe I can get her to tell me what's wrong. Is she alone?"
"No, Elana's with her. I don't think she'll be willing to leave. Won't that complicate things?"
"I'll take care of it. Let's get to the bottom of this before it goes any further."
Sophrenia's obvious concern worried Sparhawk all the more. He followed her back to the royal quarters with growing apprehension. She was right about one thing. Afriel was not in any way susceptible to human illnesses, so this was no simple miasmic fever, or one of the innumerable childhood diseases that all humans catch, endure, and get over. He dismissed out of hand the notion that there could be such a thing as the sniffles of the gods. Sophrenia was very businesslike. She was muttering the steric spell before she even entered Danae's room.
"Thank God you're here, Sophrenia," Elana exclaimed,
half rising from her chair beside the little girl's bed.
"I've been so..."
Sophrenia released the spell with a curious flick of her hand, and Elana's eyes went blank. She froze in place, half risen from her chair, and with one hand partially extended. Sophrenia approached the bed, sat on the edge of it, and took the little girl in her arms.
"Afriel," she said, "wake up. It's me, Sophrenia."
The child goddess opened her eyes and began to cry.
"What is it?"
Sophrenia asked, holding her sister even more tightly and rocking back and forth with her.
"They're killing my children, Sophrenia," Afriel wailed. "All over Eosia. The Alenes are killing my children. I want to die." "We have to go to Sarsos," Sophrenia said to Sparhawk and Vanyan a short while later, when the three of them were alone. "I have to talk with the Thousand."
"I know that it's breaking her heart," Vanyan said. "But it can't really hurt her, can it?"
"It could kill her, Vanyan. The younger gods are so totally involved with their worshippers that their very lives depend on them. Please, Sparhawk, ask Belium to take us to Sarsos immediately."
Sparhawk nodded bleakly and took out the box, touching his ring to the lid.
"Open."
He said it more sharply than he'd intended. The lid snapped up.
"Blue Rose," Sparhawk said, "a crisis hath arisen. The child goddess is made gravely ill by reason of the murder of her worshippers in far-off Eosia. We must at once to Sarsos, that Sophrenia might consult with the Thousand of Styricum regarding a cure."
"It shall be as thou dost require, Annika."
The words came from Vanyan's mouth. The preceptor's expression turned slightly uncertain.
"Is it proper for me to tell thee that I feel sympathy for thee and thy mate, for this illness of thine only child?"
"I do appreciate thy kind concern, Blue Rose."
"My concern doth not arise merely from kindness, Annika. Twice hath the gentle hand of the child goddess touched me, and even I am not proof against the subtle magic of her touch. For the love we all bear her, let us away to Sarsos, that she may be made whole again."
The world seemed to shift and blur, and the three of them found themselves outside the marble-sheathed council hall in Sarsos. Autumn was further along here, and the birch forest lying on the outskirts of the city was ablaze with color.
"You two wait here," Sophrenia told them. "Let's not stir up the hotheads by marching the Alenes into the council chamber again."
Sparhawk nodded and opened Belium's golden case to put the jewel away.
"Nay, Annika,"
Belium told him, still speaking through Vanyan's lips,
"I would know how Sophrenia's proposal is received."
"An it please thee, Blue Rose," Sparhawk replied politely.
Sophrenia went quickly up the marble steps and inside.
"It's cooler here," Vanyan noted, pulling his cloak a little tighter about him.
"Yes," Sparhawk agreed. "It's farther north."
"That more or less exhausts the weather as a topic. Quit worrying, Sparhawk. Sophronia has a great deal of influence with the Thousand. I'm sure they'll agree to help.
They waited as the minutes dragged by. It was probably half an hour later when Sparhawk felt a sharp surge, almost a shudder, pass through the Bellium.
Come with me, Annika!
Vanyan's voice was sharp, abrupt. What is it?
The hysteric love of endless talk discontents me. I must needs go past the Thousand to the younger gods themselves. These babblers do talk away the life of Aphriel.
Sparhawk was a bit surprised by the vehemence in Vanyan's voice. He followed as his preceptor, walking in a gait that was peculiarly not his own, stormed into the building. The bronze doors to the council chamber may have been locked. The screech of tortured metal that accompanied Vanyan's abrupt opening of them suggested that they had been, at any rate. Sophronia was standing before the council, her hands upraised, pleading for aid. She broke off and stared incredulously at Vanyan as he burst through the door.
"We don't allow Alines in here,"
one of the council members on a back bench shrieked in Styric, rising to his feet and waving his arms. Then a sort of strangled silence filled the chamber. Vanyan began to swell, spreading upward and outward into enormity, even as an intensely blue aura flickered brighter and brighter around him. Flickers of lightning surged through that aura, and ripping peals of thunder echoed shockingly back from the marble-clad walls. Sophronia stared at Vanyan in sudden awe. Prompted by an unvoiced suggestion that only he could hear, Sparhawk raised the glowing sapphire rose.
"Behold Bellium," he roared, "and hearken unto its mighty voice. Hear my words, ye Thousand of Styricum."
The voice coming from the enormity that a moment before had been Vanyan was vast. It was a voice to which mountains would listen, and for which waves and torrents would stop at once to hear.
"I would speak with your gods. Too small are ye, and too caught up in endless babble to consider this matter."
Sparhawk winced. Diplomacy, he saw, was not one of Bellium's strong suits. One of the white-robed counselors drew himself up, spluttering indignantly.
"This is outrageous! We don't have to—"
He was suddenly gone, and in his place stood a confused-looking personage who appeared to have been interrupted in the middle of his bath. Naked and dripping, he gaped at the huge, blue-lighted presence and at the glowing jewel in Sparhawk's hand.
"Well, really—"
he protested.
"Cetrus,"
the profound voice said sharply,
"how deep is thy love for thy cousin Aphriel?" "This is most irregular,"
the youthful god protested.
"How deep is thy love?"
The voice was inexorable. "I adore her, naturally. We all do, but—"
"What wouldst thou give to save her life?"
"Anything she asks, of course. But how could her life be in danger?"
"Thou knowest that Zelasta of Styricum is a traitor, dost thou not?"
There were gasps from the council. "Aphriel said so," the god replied, "but we thought she might have been a little excited. You know how she is sometimes."
"She told thee truly, Cetrus. Even now do Zelasta's minions slaughter her worshippers in far-off Eosia. With each death is she made less. If this be permitted to continue, soon she will be no more."
The god Cetrus stiffened, his eyes suddenly blazing.
"Monstrous!" "What wilt thou give that she may live?"
"Mine own life, if need be," Cetrus replied with archaic formalism.
"Wilt thou lend her of thine own worshippers?"
Cetrus stared at the glowing Bellium, his face filled with chagrin.
"Quickly, Cetrus, even now doth the life of Aphriel ebb away."
The god drew in a deep breath.
"There is no alternative?" he asked plaintively. "None. The life of the child goddess is sustained only by love. Give her the love of certain of thy children for a time, that she may be made whole again."
Cetrus straightened.
"I will," he declared, "though it doth rend mine heart."
A determined look
crossed that divine face. And I do assure thee, world-maker, that mine shall not be the only children who will sustain the life of our beloved cousin with their love. All shall contribute equally.
Done, then.
Belium seemed fond of that expression. Ah, Citra said then, his tone slightly worried and his speech slipping into less formal colloquialism. She will give them back, won't she?
Thou hast mine assurance, divine Citrus, Sophronia promised with a smile.
The younger god looked relieved. Then his eyes narrowed slightly.
Annika, he said crisply.
Yes, divine one?
Measures must be taken to protect Afriel's remaining children. How might that best be accomplished?
Advise them to go to the chapter houses of the Knights of the Church of Kyrellos, Sparhawk replied. There will they be kept from all harm.
And who doth command these knights?
Archprelate Dolmont, I suppose, Sparhawk replied dubiously. It is he who doth exercise ultimate authority.
I will speak with him. Where may I find him?
He will be in the Basilica in Kyrellos, Divine One.
I will go there and seek him out, that we may consult together regarding this matter.
Sparhawk nearly choked on the theological implications of that particular announcement. Then he looked at Sophronia's face. She was still regarding Vanyan with a certain amount of awe. Then, so clearly that he could almost hear the click in her mind, Sophronia made a decision. Her whole face, her entire being, announced it louder than words.
Olaf, Calton said irritably, pay attention. You've been wool-gathering for the past 2 weeks. What's got you so distracted?
I don't like the reports we've been getting back from Aton,
the big Genidian replied, shifting the Princess Danae, Rollo, and Myrrh around in his lap. The little princess had been confined to her room for 10 days by her illness, and this was her first day back among them. She was engaging in one of her favorite pastimes, lap-switching. Sparhawk knew that most of his friends really didn't pay much attention, responding automatically to her mute, wan little appeals to be picked up and held. In actuality, however, Afriel, with Toy and with Cat, was very busily going from lap to lap to re-establish contact with those who might have drifted out of her grasp during her illness. As always, there were kisses involved, but those kisses were not really the spontaneous little demonstrations of affection they seemed. Afriel could change minds and alter moods with a touch. With a kiss, however, she could instantly take possession of the entirety of someone's heart and soul. Whenever Sparhawk was engaged in a dispute with his daughter, he was always very careful to keep at least one piece of furniture between them.
Things aren't working out the way I thought they would, Uloth said in a gloomy voice. The trolls are learning to hide from arrows and crossbow bolts.
Even a troll is bound to learn eventually, Talon said.
Talon seemed fully recovered from his tumble out of the maple tree, although he still complained of headaches occasionally.
No, Uloth disagreed. That's the whole point. Trolls don't learn. Maybe it's because their gods don't learn, or can't. The trolls that are walking around right now know exactly what the first troll who ever lived knew. No more, no less. Sirgon's tampering with them. If he alters the trolls to the point that they can learn things, mankind's going to be in serious trouble.
There's something more, too, isn't there, Olaf?
Bevier asked shrewdly.
You've had your theological expression on your face for the past several days. You're tussling with some moral dilemma, aren't you?
Olaf sighed.
This is probably going to upset everybody, but try to consider it on its merits, instead of just going up in flames about it. That doesn't sound too promising, old boy, Stragan murmured. You'd better break it to us gently.
I don't think there is a gentle way, Stragan. Betwana's dispatches are getting more and more shrill. The trolls won't come out in the open anymore. The mounted Aetons can't get at them with lances, and the arrows and crossbow bolts are hitting more trees than trolls. They're even setting grass fires so they can hide in the smoke. Betwana is right on the verge of calling her people home. and without the Aetons, we don't have an army anymore.
Sir Ulof, Lascagne said, I gather that this gloomy preamble is a preparation for a shocking suggestion. I think we've all been sufficiently prepared. Go ahead and shock us.
We have to take the trolls away from Sirgon,
Ulof replied, absently scratching Murr's ears.
We can't let him continue to teach them even rudimentary tactics, and we definitely don't want them cooperating with each other the way they have been. And how exactly are you going to take totally unmanageable brutes away from a god?
Strigan asked him.
I was sort of thinking along the lines of letting their own gods do it. The troll gods are available after all. Gwerig imprisoned them inside Belium, and Sparhawk's got Belium tucked away inside his shirt. I'd imagine that Quadge and the others would do almost anything for us if we promised to give them their freedom.
Are you mad? Strigan exclaimed. We can't turn them loose. That's unthinkable.
He dropped the pair of gold coins he always carried now.
I'd be more than happy to consider alternatives, if anyone can come up with some. The threat to Aetan is serious enough, but the longer Sirgon dominates the trolls, the more they're going to learn from him. Sooner or later they'll go back to Thalesia. Do we really want a trained army of trolls outside the gates of Emsat? We've got at least some small advantage if we deal with the troll gods. We hold the key to their freedom. But we don't really have anything Sirgon wants, except Belium itself. I'd rather deal with the troll gods myself.
Why don't we just have Sparhawk take Belium to Northern Aetan and exterminate the trolls with it?
Sparhawk shook his head.
Belium won't do that, Strigan. It won't obliterate an entire species. I know that for certain. You've got the rings. You could force it to do as you say. No, I won't do that. Belium isn't a slave. If it cooperates, it's going to have to be willingly. We can't just turn the troll gods loose, Sparhawk. I may be a thief, but I'm still a Thalesian. I'm not going to just sit by and let the trolls overrun the entire peninsula.
We haven't even talked with the troll gods yet, Strigan, Ulof told him. Why don't we see what they have to say before we decide? No matter what, though, we're going to have to do something very soon. If we don't, we're going to start seeing long columns of Aetons marching out of their barracks on their way back home.
Danny slipped down from Ulof's lap and retrieved Stragan's coins.
You dropped these, my lord, she said sweetly.
Then she frowned.
Is it my imagination? Or is one of them just a little lighter than the other?
Strigan looked at her with a slightly sick expression on his face. It was somewhat later, and Sparhawk and Vanyan were escorting Sophronia back to her room. They reached the door and stopped.
Oh, this is absurd, Sophronia suddenly burst out in an exasperated tone of voice. Vanyan, go get your things and come back home where you belong.
Vanyan blinked.
Hush.
She told him. Then she glared at Sparhawk.
And not a word out of you either.
Me?
You have packing to do, Vanyan, she said. Don't just stand there gawking.
I'll get right at it.
And don't take all day.
She threw her arms up in the air.
Men, do I have to draw pictures for you? I did everything short of lighting signal fires and blowing trumpets, and all you wanted to talk about was the weather, or fish. Why wouldn't you ever get to the point?
Well, he floundered. You were very angry with me, Sophronia.
That was then. This is now. I'm not angry anymore, and I want you to come back home. I'm going to go have a word with Danae, and I want to see you back in our room when I return.
Yes, dear, he replied meekly.
She glared at him for a moment, and then she spun on her heel and went off down the hall, talking to herself and waving her hands in the air.
Well, Krieger's back, Talon reported as they gathered again later that afternoon. One of the beggars saw him slipping in through the back gate of the Senescan Embassy about 2 hours ago. Staggering might be a better word for it, though. He was roaring drunk.
That's the Krager we've come to know and love. Colton laughed.
I can't understand how Zelasta can put any faith in a known drunkard, Oscania said.
Krager's very intelligent when he's sober, Your Excellency, Sparhawk explained. That was the only reason Martell put up with him.
He scratched at his cheek.
Could we prevail on you to go back to that lookout near the embassy, Anaray?
Zanisha started to rise from her chair.
Not right now, he smiled. It usually takes Krager all night to sober up, so tomorrow morning should be soon enough. I think we'll want to know what instructions he brings to the Senescan ambassador.
There's something else, too, Stragan added. We've never really been sure if Krager knows that we're using criminals to gather information for us. He knew that we were getting help from Platymy in Samura, and that we had contact with thieves and the like in other cities in Eosia. But we should find out if he's made the connection between the two continents yet.
He sort of hinted that he knew when he talked with me after we put down the coup, Sparhawk reminded him.
I don't want to discard the entire apparatus on the basis of a hint, Sparhawk, Stragan said, and I really need to know if he's aware of the fact that we can use certain criminals for things other than spying.
I shall probe his mind most closely,
Zanisha promised. Where are Vanyan and Sophrenia, Sparhawk? Elana asked suddenly. They should have been here an hour ago.
Oh, I'm sorry, dear. I meant to tell you about that. I excused them for the rest of the day. They have something important to take care of.
Why didn't you tell me?
I am, dear. Right now.
What are they doing?
They've resolved their differences. I'd imagine they're discussing that right now. At some length.
She flushed slightly. Oh, she said in a neutral sort of way. What finally got them back together again? He shrugged.
Sophrenia got tired of the estrangement and told Vanyan to come back home. She was very direct about it, and she even managed to twist it around so that it was all his fault. You know how that goes.
That will do, Sir Knight, she said firmly.
Yes, Your Majesty.
Would this Krager person know where Zelasta is right now, Prince Sparhawk? Oscania asked.
I'm sure he does, Your Excellency. Zelasta probably doesn't want him to know, Krager being what he is and all, but it's very hard to hide things from Krager when he's the least bit sober.
He could be enormously valuable to us, Prince Sparhawk, particularly in the light of the Anaray's special gift.
You'd better get all you can from him right now, Your Excellency, Talon suggested,
because just as soon as my brother gets back from Aton, he'll probably kill him.
Oscania looked startled.
It's a personal thing, Your Excellency. Krager was involved in the death of our father. Around the edges, anyway. Khalad wants to do something about that.
I'm sure we can persuade him to wait, young master.
I wouldn't be, Your Excellency.
It's been a part of us for so long that I don't think we'd be Styrix without it, Anaray,
Sophrenia said sadly. It was one of those private meetings at the top of the tower. Sparhawk and his daughter had joined Sophrenia, Vanyan, and Zanisha as evening settled over Matherion, so that they could discuss certain things the others did not need to know about.
It is even so with us, Sophrenia of Ilara,
Zanisha confessed.
Our hatred of thy race doth in part define the Delphae as well. We tell our children that the Delphae steal souls, Sophrenia said. I was always taught that you glow because of the souls you've devoured, and that the people you touch decay because you've jerked their souls out of them.
Zanisha smiled.
And we tell our young ones that the Styrix are ghouls who rob graves for food when there are no Delphaic children nearby to be eaten alive.
I know a child with a slightly Styrix background who's been considering cannibalism lately, Sparhawk noted blandly.
Snitch,
Danae muttered.
What's this?
Sophrenia demanded of her sister.
The child goddess was very upset when she found out that Zelasta had deceived her, Sparhawk said in an offhand sort of way. and even more upset when she discovered that he wanted to steal you from her. She said she was going to rip his heart out and eat it right before his very eyes.
Oh, I probably wouldn't have done it,
Afriel tried to shrug it off.
Probably?
Sophrenia exclaimed.
His heart's so rotten it would have made me sick.
Sophrenia gave her a long, steady look of disapproval.
Oh, all right, the child goddess said. I was exaggerating.
She looked pensively out over the city, then back at Sophrenia and Zanisha.
All this hatred and the wild stories the Styrix and the Delphi tell their children about each other aren't really natural, you realize. You've been very carefully coached to feel this way. The real argument was between my family and Eudamus, and it involved things you wouldn't even understand. It was a silly argument. Most arguments are. But gods can't keep their arguments private. You humans were drawn into something that didn't really concern you at all. She sighed. Like so many of our disagreements, that one started to spill over from the part of the world where we live into your part. It's our party, and you never should have been invited.
Where is this country of yours, Afriel? Vanyan asked curiously.
Right here, she shrugged. All around us, but you can't see it. It might be better if we had our own separate place, but it's too late now. I should have told Sophrenia about our foolishness when she and I were children, and I heard her parroting some of that nonsense about the Delphi. But then the Aline serfs destroyed our village and killed our parents, and Zelasta tried to shift his own guilt to the Delphi, and that set her prejudices in stone. She paused. I always knew there was something about Zelasta's story that didn't ring true, but I couldn't get into his thoughts to find out what it was.
Why not? Vanyan asked her. You are a goddess, after all.
You've noticed, she exclaimed. What a thrilling discovery that must have been for you.
Mind your manners, Sparhawk told her.
Sorry, Vanyan, she apologized. That was a little snippy, wasn't it? I can't look into Zelasta's thoughts, because he isn't one of my children.
She paused.
Sophrenia, don't you find it interesting that I'm limited, but Zanisha isn't? Zanisha and I are exploring our differences, Afriel,
Sophrenia smiled.
Every one of them we've examined so far has turned out to be imaginary. Truly,
Zanisha agreed. Sparhawk could only begin to imagine how difficult even these tentative steps toward peacemaking must be for this strangely similar pair of women. The tearing down of institutionalized bigotry must have been somewhat akin to dismantling a house that had been standing for 100 centuries.
Vanyan, dear,
Sophrenia said then,
it's starting to get a little chilly.
I'll run down and fetch your cloak, she sighed.
No, Vanyan, she told him, I don't want a cloak. I want you to put your arms around me.
Oh, he said, I should have thought of that myself.
Yes,
she agreed.
Try to think of it more often.
He smiled and put his arms about her.
That's so much nicer,
she said, snuggling up against him. There's something I've been meaning to ask, Sparhawk said to his daughter. Regardless of who put them up to it, the people who attacked Ilara were Alines. How in the world did you ever persuade Sophrenia to take on the chore of teaching the Pandians the secrets? She must have hated Alines.
She did.
The child goddess shrugged.
And I wasn't too fond of you myself. I had Gwerig's rings, though, and I absolutely had to get them on the fingers of King Antor and the first Sparhawk. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here.
She paused, and her eyes narrowed.
That's intolerable, she exclaimed.
What is?
Delia manipulated me. After I stole the rings from Gwerig, or maybe even before, it put the notion into the rings themselves. I know it did. I no sooner took those rings than the idea occurred to me to separate them by giving one of them to your ancestor and the other to Aelana's. This has all been Belium's scheme. That thing used me.
My, my, Sparhawk said blandly.
And it was so clever,
she fumed.
It seemed like such a good idea. Your blue friend and I are going to have a long talk about this.
You were telling us how you forced Sophrenia to become our tutor, I believe, he said.
I commanded her to do it, after coaxing wouldn't work. First I ordered her to take the rings to that pair of bleeding savages, and then I took her to your mother house at Demos and compelled her to become your tutor. I had to have her there to keep your family on the right track. You're Annika, and I knew I'd need some kind of hold on you. Otherwise, Ilium would have had you all to itself, and I didn't trust it enough to let that happen.
Then you did plan all this in advance, Sparhawk said just a bit sadly.
Ilium may have planned it first, she said darkly. I was absolutely sure it was my idea. I thought that if I just happened to be your daughter, you'd at least pay some attention to me.
He sighed. It was all completely calculated then, wasn't it?
Yes, but that doesn't have anything to do with the way I feel about you. I had a great deal to do with inventing you, Sparhawk, so I do really love you. You were a darling baby. I almost disassembled Colton when he broke your nose. Sophrenia talked me out of it, though. Mother was a different story. You were sweet, but she was adorable. I loved her from the first moment I saw her, and I knew you two would get on well together. I'm really rather proud of the way things have turned out. I even think Ilium approves. Of course, it would never admit it. Ilium's so stuffy sometimes.
Did your cousin Cetrus actually go into the Basilica and talk with Dolmont? Venian asked her suddenly.
Yes.
How did Dolmont take it?
Surprisingly well. Of course, Cetrus can be very charming when he wants to be, and Dolmont is fond of me.
She paused, her dark eyes speculative.
I think his archprelacy is going to bring about some rather profound changes in your church, Vanyan. Dolmont's mind isn't absolutely locked in stone the way Ortsel's is. I think Aline theology is going to change a great deal while he's archprelate.
The conservatives won't like that.
They never do. Conservatives wouldn't even change their underwear if they didn't have to.
That's extremely questionable from a legal standpoint, Your Majesty, Oscania said. I'm not personally questioning your word, Anaray, he added quickly, but I think we can all see the problem here. All we'll have in the way of evidence is Zanisha's unsubstantiated testimony about what somebody's thinking. Even the most pliable of judges is likely to choke a bit on that. These are going to be very difficult cases to prosecute, particularly in view of the fact that some of the accused are going to be members of the great families of Tamil proper.
You might as well go ahead and tell them all of it, Stragan, Sparhawk suggested. You're going to carry out your plan anyway, and they'll worry over legal niceties for weeks if you don't tell them.
Stragan winced.
I really wish you hadn't brought it up, old boy, he said in a pained voice. Their Majesties are official personages, and they're more or less obliged to observe the strict letter of the law. They'd both be much more comfortable if they didn't know too many details.
I'm sure they would. But all this fretting about building ironclad court cases is wasting time we should be spending on other problems.
What's this? Sarabian asked.
Milord Stragan and Master Kaalador are contemplating something along the lines of what you might call legal shortcuts, Your Majesty, in the interests of expediency. Do you want to tell them, Stragan? Or do you want me to do it?
You go ahead. It might sound better coming from you.
Stragan leaned back, still brooding over his two gold coins.
Their plan's very simple, Your Majesty, Sparhawk told the Emperor. They propose that instead of rounding up all these conspirators, spies, informers, and the like, we just have them murdered.
What? Sarabian exclaimed.
That was a very blunt way to put it, Sparhawk,
Stragan complained. I'm a blunt man.
Sparhawk shrugged.
Actually, Your Majesty, I sort of approve of the notion. Vanyan's having a little trouble choking it down, though.
He leaned back in his chair.
Justice is a funny thing, he observed. She's only partly interested in punishing the guilty. What she's really interested in is deterrence. The idea is to frighten people into avoiding crime by doing unpleasant things, publicly, to the criminals who get caught. But as Stragan pointed out, most criminals know that they probably won't get caught, so all the police and the courts are really doing is justifying their continued employment. He suggests that we bypass the police and the courts and send out the murderers some night very soon.
The next morning, everybody even remotely connected with Zelasta and his renegade Styrix would be found with his throat cut. If we want a deterrent, that would really be the most effective one. There wouldn't be any acquittals or appeals or imperial pardons to confuse the issue. If we do it that way, everybody in all of Tomalee will have nightmares about the fruits of treason for years afterward. I approve of the idea for tactical reasons, though. I'll leave justice to the courts, or the gods. I like the idea because of the damage it would do to Zelasta. He's a Styrix, and Styrix usually try to get what they want by deception and misdirection. Zelasta's set up a very elaborate apparatus to gain his ends without a direct confrontation. Stragan's plan would destroy that apparatus in a single night, and only madmen would be willing to join Zelasta after that. Once the apparatus is gone, he'll have to come out in the open and fight. He's not good at that, but we are. This would give us the chance to fight this war on our own terms, and that's always an enormous tactical advantage. And we can pick our own time, Kalidor added. The timing would be very important.
They wouldn't be expecting it. That's one thing, Itania noted.
There are rules, Itania, his brother objected. Civilizations based on rules. If we break the rules, how can we expect others to follow them?
That's the whole point, Oskanya. Right now, the rules are protecting the criminals, not society as a whole. We can wriggle around and come up with some kind of legalistic justification for it afterward. About the only real objection I have is that these, agents of government policy, shall we say, won't have any official standing.
He frowned for a moment.
I suppose we could solve that problem by appointing Milord Stragan to the post of Minister of the Interior and Master Kalidor, Director of the Secret Police.
Real secret, Your Excellency. Kalidor laughed. I don't even know who most of the murderers are.
Itania smiled. Those are the best kind, I suppose.
He looked at the Emperor.
That would put a slight stain of legality on the whole business, Your Majesty, in the event that you decide to go ahead with it.
Sarabian leaned thoughtfully back in his chair.
I'm tempted, he said. A bloodbath like this would ensure domestic tranquility in Tomalee for at least a century.
He shook off his expression of wistful yearning and sat up.
It's just too uncivilized. I couldn't approve of something like that with Lady Sophronia and Anarae Zanisha watching me and sitting in judgment.
What are your feelings, Zanisha?
Sophronia asked tentatively.
We of the Delphae are not over-concerned with niceties and technicalities, Sophronia. I didn't think you would be. Good is good, and bad is bad, wouldn't you say? It seemeth so to me, and to me as well.
Zelasta's hurt the both of us, and Stragan's massacre would hurt him. I don't think either of us would object too much to something that would cause him pain, would we?
Zanisha smiled.
It's your decision, then, Sarabian,
Sophronia said.
Don't look to Zanisha and me for some excuse not to make it. We find nothing objectionable in the plan.
I'm profoundly disappointed in both of you, he told them. I was hoping you'd get me off the hook. You're my last chance, Elana. Doesn't this monstrous notion turn your blood cold?
Not particularly,
she shrugged.
But I'm an Aline, and a politician. As long as we don't get caught with bloody knives in our own hands, we can always wriggle out of it.
Won't anyone help me?
Sarabian actually looked desperate. Oskanya gave his emperor a penetrating look.
It has to be your decision, Your Majesty, he said. I personally don't like it, but I'm not the one who has to give the order.
Is it always like this, Elana?
Sarabian groaned.
Usually, she replied quite calmly. Sometimes it's worse.
The Emperor sat staring at the wall for quite some time.
All right, Stragan, he said finally. Go ahead and do it.
That's Mother's darling boy,
Elana said fondly. End of Side 10. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.